Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American Nightmare.
Hey guys, this is Megan Cloherty and Jack Moore. Say hi. There you are. We're doing a little something different this week. As you may know, we're still working on putting this podcast together, and we needed to take a week to work on the rest of the episodes still to come. So instead, we thought we'd answer some of the questions we're getting from listeners. So I'm here not only with Jack Moore, but here with Julia Ziegler.
Hi, everybody.
You've heard her name before if you've made it all the way through the credits, where we mentioned that she is our content advisor. Basically, she makes sure we're making sense and we're not missing anything that... You know, we're pretty close to this project, Jack and I. We're like living and breathing it. So sometimes when you're really close to something, you need a, kind of a third eye on it. So she's making sure all of it makes sense for you guys. So we picked a few questions we got both on our blog, 22hourspodcast.com, and on social media. Thanks for sending those in. I should tell you, too, that we're planning a big unanswered questions episode for the end of the project. So if you have any burning questions or things that are just driving you crazy, please send them in to us because we can include them in a future episode. We're doing about five or six questions today, and Jules is going to ask the questions, so we're going to do our best to answer them. Take it away.
First, I wanted to tell you guys thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome.
I feel like these are the kinds of conversations that we have behind the scenes all the time. Sometimes I feel validated when I see the questions come in. I'm like, I had that question too. So thank you as well to everybody who's listening to the podcast and for being so invested in it, because it means a lot to all of us involved in this. All right, so this first question comes from Dale, who wrote into our live blog, again, available at 22hourspodcast.com. And Dale says, I just can't come to terms with the passionate nature of this crime. In general, that kind of rage is often only at play when the attacker is close to the victims. What on earth set this guy off? And why $40,000? It seems an odd amount. Why not $50,000 or $100,000? I wonder where that figure came from.
Well, I think, you know, to the first question, you know, kind of where does that rage come from? That's something that Megan and I have struggled with, you know, from the beginning of the trial. And it's something that's not really the motive in the case being all about the money. It's not really explained by the brutality of the crime. But what we do know from the evidence introduced by prosecutors is that Darren Wint, at the time of the murders, was facing a very precarious living situation. He was in desperate need of money, and he seemed to be kind of preoccupied with this idea of easy money. He was obsessed with playing the lottery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, beyond that, we don't really have, you know, much insight into his psychological motivations. But I will say that later on in the podcast, we do talk to a very well-known criminal profiler who kind of gives us his best assessment of the killer and the crime.
Right. And then the 40 grand is a really good point, because 40 grand, well, I mean, it's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And it made a huge difference in Darren's life because he had all these things he couldn't afford. But when you hear four people were killed and he left with 40 grand, it's like, well, that's it. You know, especially right. Thinking how much money the Savopoulos family had, maybe. So Jack and I have a theory about that. Really never came up specifically in trial about why that amount. But Jack and I think basically because Savo was facilitating this money being pulled out of the bank, right? So he's calling his sister. He's calling the CFO, Ted, to try and make sure that this happens and organizing with the Bank of America, you know, what branch they're going to pick it up from. We think that he picked that amount of money because it wouldn't raise a red flag. Because if he had said, I need to take out, you know, $100,000, I think that he didn't normally do that. I mean, from what we learned from his sister and from Ted Chase, 40 grand was something that Sava tended to take out if when he went to auctions, because you don't know how much money you're going to need at your disposal. Usually he had to pay for things in cash. Those, you know, specialized pieces of equipment usually cost tens of thousands of dollars. So 40 grand was a number that he could say, hey, I need to take 40 grand out. I need to use it tomorrow. And it wouldn't raise any suspicions from Debbie Masser or from Ted Chase. They would think, oh, okay, you know, the boss just is going to go to an auction. And if he would have said, I need $1 million or I need, you know, something completely outrageous, it would have made them think, wait a minute, what's going on? So I think that's the 40 grand answer that we can come up with. But as far as prosecutors, you know, as a hard answer, we don't really know exactly why that number.
Well, and the other side of it is, right, like I think initially your brain goes to that's the amount that the kidnapper requested, but not necessarily, right? Maybe,
right.
Maybe it was Sava who suggested a certain amount. I can get you $40,000.
Yeah.
I can get you $30,000. And that became the number. Maybe, you know, unfortunately, as we've said a lot through the podcast, there's just certain things about this case that we will never know unless someone who was there told us. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, yeah, it may not have been a number that Darren requested.
Right.
It could be, you know, could have been something else. The Dale's first part of her question about the passionate nature of the crime and kind of that rage, I think we've heard that a lot, you know, and I think it's a question that people that I have that have spoken to me about the podcast have asked too. You know, was this a burglary gone wrong? Mm-hmm. If he was just trying to get the money, was this the plan all along to go in and for this to be such a gruesome crime? Or is it something that developed along the way for whatever reasons? And again, we just will unfortunately never know.
Right. I mean, we talked about how, you know, there is sort of the theory out there that maybe this was just a kidnap and ransom. And then there's that moment where he opens the front door and the security camera clicks on when he goes to pick up the pizza. Is that the turning point? I mean, we don't know because we're not in Darren Wynn's head. And we don't know because he didn't say anything about it. But it does seem, and we'll of course get into this more because there is more of this podcast to come, and we're still writing it. Jack's like
and,
taking
you know,
a heavy sigh. But what? Just to finish my thought, I mean, I don't think we'll know if this was planned because there is no indication that it was.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm thinking of, we talked to a veteran, retired federal prosecutor, Glenn Kirshner, who has tried many murder cases in D.C. Superior Court alongside Laura Bach. And he told us, he said, listen, murder doesn't make sense.
Mm.
So I think, you know, that's kind of been a point I return to when I, you know, can spend a lot of time trying to put myself into the mind of a killer. But murder does not make sense.
All right. Emma asks, the upstairs floor plan map on the website, that's our 22hourspodcast.com website, only shows 3 bedrooms. Where was Phillip's room? I know he was found in the girls' room. But wouldn't there be 4 bedrooms since it was 3 children and the parents? Great question.
Yeah.
So, and this, in the, as you said, the floor plans are on 22hourspodcast.com. And there was a third story to the house. We don't have the floor plans for that. I'm not sure that the prosecutors even mocked up the third floor. There was no indication that any part of the crime took place there.
Yeah. I mean, there would be smoke damage up there because the fire started on the second floor. So obviously it would have gone up to the third floor. But there was no indication there were any parts of the crime that took place there. So even if they showed it initially, I mean, that's what you're saying, right? Even if they showed it initially, it's not like they dwelled on that
portion. I think, and we definitely saw photographs. There was Phillip's room was up there, kind of a rec room. And that was also where the utility room, where the security system computer was stored. And we know the hard drive for that computer was taken from the house and never found.
And I think, too, I mean, one of the things is, you know, again, it's you get back to a lot of kind of questions that we might not have ever have the answers to. But my brain goes to, well, where was Philip when the intruder came in? You know, was he, and we don't know, was he upstairs in his bedroom? Was he in the living room, you know, watching TV as a kid home from school might do?
In the kitchen getting a snack.
Is he in the kitchen getting a snack? We just don't know. So it's not, you know, even if he was in one of these other places, you know, because realistically, it's not realistic that he would have been in his sister's bedroom, right? When the intruder came in. There's logically, we could assume that he was somewhere else and perhaps moved into that room, just like we assume that some of the other adults were moved into certain rooms.
Right, which actually gets us to our next question, I think.
This is from Mary, also on the live blog. She wanted to know if there are any thoughts about why Philip was separated from the adults.
It's a good question. It's interesting how that wasn't really, they didn't spend a lot of time on the trial in that because, again, it's one of those things they don't know. And we've found going through this that prosecutors, if they don't know, they're not going to bring it up and spend a lot of time on it. What we know, Mary, is where they ended up, where firefighters found them. So whether Philip was separated in the last 5 minutes of this crime or whether he was separated at the very beginning, I mean, we just have no idea. Your brain, and I think, you know, we've talked to experts about this, it's hard to think that he wasn't used against the adults as far as separating them because, you know, they either wanted the adults to think that they were doing something to Philip to either extort them or to, you know, to add urgency to the situation, or if they separated him to intentionally hurt him. We don't know. I mean, it's a horrible thing to think about. But yeah, we know that the three adults were found in one room in chairs, evidence that they had been tied to those chairs. We know that Philip was in the adjoining room on the bed.
And we don't have, based on the crime scene and how much destruction was done in that room, where, you know, we can assume that Philip was restrained in some kind of way. But unlike the adults, we don't have, there's no evidence left to kind of support how exactly he would have been restrained because that room was burned.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the fire, as you may remember, the fire started on the bed. And with a fire victim, we kind of, especially because it's Philip, because he's a child, we didn't go into his injuries as in detail. But there was no evidence on his wrists at all. And they couldn't find anything, whether it was neckties or zip ties or whatever.
Well, it is. Yeah, this is one of those kind of inconclusive answers because they did find a tie near his body, but he wore a tie for his school uniform. So it's hard to say.
Was that just left on the bed? Was it? Yeah.
Right. Was he wearing his tie for his school uniform? Was it used to restrain him? We don't know.
It was a yellow necktie that had little sailor knots on it.
You know, it's interesting because it's actually one of the questions that I've had, and I didn't even bring this up to you guys when we were editing the podcast, but in the episode where we talk about what Philip was wearing, mm-hmm. or what they found on him, and you mentioned the tie, I always thought to myself, why would he have been wearing a tie if he was going to the doctor's office? And now I'm just having this epiphany of, well, there was a chance that Philip was still going to go to school that day. So him wearing his school uniform and having his tie on, you know, they could have been fully planning to take him to school, and then that, you know, the plans changed for whatever reason. But I'm kind of having an aha moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's, you have to remember too, this is a really upscale boys' school, so they by uniform that was a khaki, you know, button up shirt tie.
With a tie.
It's hard to believe as a little kid you wouldn't come home and just pull off a tie and put on a t-shirt. But again, we don't know Philip. You know, I mean, maybe that also speaks to the timeline of the crime. So you can really go down. Mm-hmm. It's like the rabbit holes we tell you. You can really just be like lost in these things. But yeah, all we know is that a tie was found near his body.
Near him.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Come.
We're back and changing it up this week. We're in the studio answering some of your questions with our content advisor, Julia Ziegler.
Andrea asks, did the investigators look at cameras from houses around this house? Were there cameras at the Australian ambassador's residence or any other businesses nearby? I realize these are big houses, but I would think that also means they would have good security systems.
So just to kind of refresh everyone's memory, the two grounds workers at the Australian ambassador's residence across the street saw a man matching Darren Wynn's description approach the house from 32nd Street, walk up to the garage, slip inside. They said that the Australian ambassador's residence does have security cameras, but none face 32nd Street. Mm. And that was, you know, kind of interesting. This was a very upscale neighborhood. You would think that, you know, maybe somebody's security camera would have captured something, but there was no, you know, none of that, no other security camera, you know, footage from other houses was introduced as evidence. And I think, you know, Megan and I have been talking about this, and we, you know, May 2015 is really before, I guess, what you'd call kind of the consumerization of home security systems really took off. Mm-hmm. You know, now people who do not live in a $4.5 million house have, you know, these like amazing security systems you can pull up on your smartphone
right. And
see your front porch.
It was ringing your doorbell and all, yeah.
But this May 2015, that was still, you know, cutting edge. I don't think a lot of people had that yet, you know, even very wealthy people. So I think, you know, it was only people who had like a literal security camera installed and, you know, you're going to have it facing your property, not
exactly.
The street.
Well, exactly right.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, too, because I think we say that it's around the side of the Savopoulos' house is where the garage is. If you were standing where the garage was looking at the Australian ambassador's residence, there's a walled, like a brick wall that goes past eye height. And then there's a tennis court. And then it's the side of his house.
And a fence.
Right. So it's sort of like, it makes sense to me why, I mean, you to even get to the house, you'd have to broach like two fences. So he probably has one facing the front of his house. I mean, not to get into their security system because we don't know. But it makes sense sort of that it's kind of like a dead spot on the road, if you will, where there's not a lot of, there's no entrances there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, to answer your question in a long way, that's why there wouldn't be any cameras pointed that way, I guess.
Yeah, and we should say, too, I mean, sometimes we take for granted because we all live here in D.C., and honestly, I personally drive past that road, you know, all the time. So I'm very intimately familiar with where this crime took place. It's very residential. You know, people might think D.C. and think big city and, you know.
Big brothers watching you.
Yeah, but these are big homes, and there is a fair amount of space between them, especially on that corner, because they were on a corner lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's some space there. And to Jack's point, if you have a home security camera, most times that's going to be inside your home, right? You're going to have cameras inside. And then the ones that are outside is going to be, you know, facing your front porch or
right. Something
like that. It's not going to be
looking
kind
at
of
the street.
Right. And having such a big range of focus.
Yeah.
You know, it's
going
to be very, very close to your own property.
And no businesses near there, Andrea, either. It's all residential, so there was no businesses to speak of.
Yeah. All right. Other listeners have wanted to know if the traffic cameras might possibly have picked up any images of the driver of the Porsche when it was spotted racing into Maryland after the Savopoulos house had been set on fire.
It's funny, we've gotten a lot of questions about the traffic cameras, though it does make sense because that is something that you know there are cameras pointed
mm-hmm.
at you. Unfortunately, the short answer is no. I mean, these kind of cameras are set up high. They're set up to aim at your license plate level. A lot of them are motion activated, too, like they're based on speed. So they're not going to get everybody coming through and a picture of every single person. But if somebody's, you know, screaming through at a certain, they click on and they get a picture. They're designed to capture the car's license plates. So you can see the photos of the Porsche being tracked on traffic cameras, rather, on the blog, the 22hourspodcast.com. But there are no pictures of the people inside.
And traffic cameras, because these were traffic cameras, right? These were not like separate D.C. government cameras that are maybe, you know, set up throughout the city. We're talking about traffic cameras. So they are set up, right, to do a specific thing. Traffic cameras are not meant to catch a person's face. They're meant to catch a license plate,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you run a red light, they can catch you.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you, you know, something like that.
Well, and they're not like I mean, it's not
high res.
It's not a really good picture. I mean, you can tell it's a white van or a blue car, but you can't really, unless you really, really know cars and you know what you're looking for.
And if your car has ever been caught going through, you know, a light where there's a camera and you get that picture in the mail, that's the resolution. You know, that grainy resolution is the resolution. So even if you would happen to see an outline of a shape in a window,
you couldn't identify.
You couldn't identify a person by that.
Well, and you've been bothered by the van.
I have been bothered by the van.
Well, didn't you want to know? Because I think that the traffic camera questions,
My biggest question about the van was always whether or not, when did it end up at 24th and K? When did it get there? And was it ever at 3201 Woodland Drive? And I know we don't have any neighbors who have said that they ever saw Darren's van there. But that's been my biggest question and the thing I think that just really eats at me the most. Because if it had been at Woodland Drive at one point or around there, when did it get moved? Mm-hmm. Who moved it?
Well, so I think, Jack, I mean, not to take your words, but I want to set you up here because you had a great point maybe a couple days ago. People notice a red Mosler.
Right.
People notice a, 911 turbo electric blue. People don't notice a regular old blue minivan. I mean, wasn't that your point?
Mm-hmm. Even if it were parked in the neighborhood, why would it have stuck out to people?
Right.
And because, you know, one of the other things with the Porsche, we know the Porsche was seen. It was captured on traffic cameras, and also a witness saw it. Another driver saw it racing down New York Avenue in the direction of Prince George's County, Maryland. And the witness said the Porsche, you know, was driving erratically. And so here you have like a six-figure flashy sports car being driven erratically, and we only have one witness who saw that. You know, and there was how many people were they passing? And it only stuck out to one person. So would just a minivan parked on a quiet street, why would that, even if somebody saw it, would it even register in your mind?
Right.
You know,
that's a great point.
If it were parked, it could have been parked around the corner and somebody could have seen it. But would you remember that?
The other thing that I thought of, too, is this is a neighborhood where there were workers there constantly. I mean, even when we went there were roofers there. There were landscapers there. I mean, it's almost like there are more people in the neighborhood who are working than there are who live there.
Yeah. During the day, right?
Right. So if you're used to seeing, you know, box trucks and minivans because somebody's housekeeper stopped by or whatever, I wonder, too, if that sort of made it, unfortunately, a good place for that crime because no one's going to call in a vehicle that seems out of place.
The other thing about the van that always stuck out to me, too, and this goes back to 24th and K, was, and we've gotten some questions about this, too, from Instagram and from Twitter and the blog. We have images of the Porsche racing through D.C. and Maryland. Why, or we don't have any images of the van, like going back to my earlier question, too, right? Where are the images of the van racing through and being parked at 24th and K? You know, where are the closest cameras to 24th and K? How come the van was never picked up? We know the van's license plate, right? Like, how come it could never be tracked like the sports car was tracked?
Well, they knew when to look for the sports car. And they knew when to look for the van being towed, right, based on the timeline.
They knew when and where because they had the witness who said, I saw a blue Porsche at, 145, let's say, on New York Avenue. So I guess they could go to the traffic cameras. Oh, we have traffic cameras on New York Avenue, and they could pull the time.
And then they know when it was burned. So between that time and 145, you start scanning. If you have to go through days and days and days and days and look through grainy video for a blue minivan and you don't know what roads you're looking on, I mean.
Right, because we don't know, again, going back to my earlier point, we don't know when the van got there. We don't know how it got there. We don't know what road it took.
Right.
We don't know any of those things.
You have to have certain variables that basically, whittle down when you're looking for it.
Right. Yeah, I think, though, that, the logical kind of follow-up then is, well, isn't that the police's job or the investigator's job to go through all those cameras and find something?
It is, but it doesn't matter to the crime. It doesn't change that four people were killed. It doesn't change who did it. It doesn't change, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's interesting to know. I mean, it helps to have that puzzle piece to put in there just to complete the picture. But in the end, it's one of those details they didn't necessarily need to convict.
Yeah. And I think to that point, one of the things that we've talked about behind the scenes is that there are a lot of questions that we have or whatever, but that the prosecutors or the defense would never bring up in trial because it doesn't support their case. They're asking questions for very specific answers on both sides, right? Mm-hmm. So
sometimes the main questions don't get asked.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes the main questions don't get asked because it does, to your point, Megan, it doesn't matter at the end of the day. They're only asking the questions that are going to convict or, you know, get someone off in a case.
Okay, back to your questions about 22 Hours so far. Our content advisor, Julia Ziegler, joins us. And you may recognize her voice. She read the court transcript as defense attorney Judy Pipe in the previous episode. All right, let's get right to it.
All right, we have a question from Jocelyn on Twitter. And she says, do we know if any of the victims ate the pizza or had pizza in their stomach contents?
The big question was, so you'll remember that two pizzas were delivered. There was a cheese and a pepperoni. The cheese wasn't touched. The pepperoni is the one that Darren Wint ate, and then his saliva DNA was discovered on the crust. There's so many questions about the pizza. Why order two pizzas? Was he intending on feeding the victims? Was he just hungry? Were there more people in the house? I mean, there's so many theories around this. The medical examiner, when it came down to it, said she could not tell, based on the contents of the victim's stomachs, if they ever ate the pizza. I went back through, I saw Jocelyn's question, and I went back through the medical examiner's report and my notes on them, and we can get into it, but it's not really conclusive, but I want to share the information we have with you guys. So Sava had a green-black fluid that she couldn't identify in his stomach. Amy had 42 milliliters of tan and brown viscous fluid, but could not identify that she ate the pizza.
What is viscous fluid?
It's like a thicker fluid. Philip had 4 milliliters of red brown liquid, but can't say he ate the pizza. And Vera had acidic material that she said she usually would find in an empty stomach. And she can't say that she didn't eat the pizza. She kind of phrased it differently each time because this was over like an hour long questioning. Interestingly, and I just thought this would be worth adding, they all tested negative for alcohol. So there's no evidence that they were given any alcohol or, you know, tried to be subdued in that way. But again, you know, as we talked about before with the fire, it even affected that. You know, I mean, it changes how the composition of your body. You can't tell. And they also don't know when they died. So we don't know if maybe they'd eaten the pizza like when it was first delivered and then they were killed the next day, the pizza's going to be gone. But if, you know, it's just you can't tell. We don't know is the short answer.
Mm-hmm. From Katie on Twitter. At what point during the trial did you decide that this needed to become a podcast?
Oh,
I'm
Katie.
So glad that Katie asked this question. How did your conversations, reporting, and recording of events shift once the decision to do a podcast was made?
Oh.
Well, I'll start on this one.
You've been really shy on the mic.
I know.
I feel like you should have been doing this the whole time. That would have helped us out.
No. I enjoy being the content advisor behind the scenes, but I'm appreciating my moment here. No, it's interesting, I think, how these things happen. And I remember sitting in my office and Megan and Jack coming back, you know, the first few days of the trial, and we would be having these really long conversations. Kind of the same kind of conversations that we're having right now, where it was, what about this? What about that? Here's who testified today. Well, did they say this? Did they ask them that? And what became very evident very quickly was that there were so many details in this very important case that we weren't going to be able to answer in a way in our radio and web formats. You know, you were doing 40-second radio reports. You know, here's what happened today. Here's who testified. Here's the highlights. And Jack was writing, you know, a 1,000-word blog.
So, yeah, so he had a little more detail in there. But we kind of wanted to be on the same page every day, reporting the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting there and saying, you guys, just start recording. Like, we all kind of, like, came to, like, just start recording everything that you were talking about. Because at this point, we had already made the decision that, like, you were calling back Megan during the trial and speaking to Jack during the breaks. And that's something that we do regularly when we have multiple reporters covering the same case. And so it was kind of like this, just start recording everything. We don't know exactly what this is going to turn into, but we also, sometimes in the moment with a trial like this, you're not getting everything in chronological order, right? So we wanted to be able to tell the story in a different way that kind of sheds light on various aspects and angles of this, again, very important case.
Well, and not lose anything.
Right.
I mean, there were a lot of things. It's funny because when we talked about recording our calls, first of all, there was like a technical issue with that because I'd actually call Jack and he'd pick up the phone and be like, wait, hold on, wait. Let me, okay, I have to press record and then I could talk. But, I mean, did we think that we were going to be using it really? I don't know. I mean, I would call and be like, okay, this is the spelling of this person's name. I'm eating a tuna sandwich at the same time I'm talking to Jack. Like, it's starting to rain outside. I mean, it was just like, you're calling your coworker and being like, this is what I've got. This is what I expect for the rest of the day. I'll call you back later.
Yeah, like during the trial, I even forgot that we were recording. Like, it seems so secondary to me that we would do anything else. Like, it was during the trial, it was just like, we have to report on the trial. We have to make sure our facts are right. We have to, you know,
yeah.
It was like just recording was just in one extra step. But I didn't, just because we were recording our phone calls, I didn't think like we are now doing a podcast. It almost, you know, we were just covering the trial.
Well, and you know, and like 90% of what you are talking about, you're really not going to use. I mean, yeah. Like, it was just like, okay, this is this person. This is Diane with two N's. Like, this, you know, you're relaying all this stuff.
Yeah.
So what actually ends up being used, we didn't have any idea. But I think what was interesting, and I found, I actually was very surprised by in hearing them back, is like those days, the autopsy day and the, you know, when Darren first took the stand and he started crying. And like, as a human, I was struck in a certain way. You know, just not as a reporter, and a lot of that didn't make it into my reports every day. But I'd call Jack as a colleague and a friend, and be like, "God, I just, you know, how am I even going to say this? How am I going to say that a 10-year-old was burned to death, possibly, and was possibly alive? I mean, like, how do you even approach saying that? Let alone getting your head around it yourself." And so we end up having these sort of diaries of my experience, let alone the very, very tiny details of what people were wearing and the weather that day and just random things that you would never have noted, I don't think, or maybe you would have randomly, but it's interesting to sort of have this, I mean, really is, it's like an audio diary.
And they're unvarnished, they're kind of snap, immediate judgments. So when Darren takes a stand, I mean, it's like the minute he got off the stand, Megan came back and called me. And
right.
It was like her just immediate reaction. So it's really interesting because, you know, now it's been several months. And, you know, it's hard to remember how you felt about something or what your first impression was. So to be able to listen back and hear it, you know, it's unvarnished and it's how it played out in real time.
I was going to say, it was very organic. You know, like to what Jack said earlier, you know, you guys, you hit record. But then after that, it was just kind of like whether you would have been recording that or not for the sake of a podcast, it was exactly what you would have, you know, said.
Yeah.
Said before.
Because we didn't think we were really going to do it.
We didn't know. I think, you know, and so to answer, to further answer Katie's question, I think what happened is, so during the trial, you know, we had these audio diaries that you guys had. And then after the trial, we kind of all sat down, right, and said, okay, if we're doing this, we talked about doing a podcast, and if we're going to do it, kind of what shape does that take, and how would we go about this? And, you know, this is a very sensitive case.
And why?
And
I mean,
yeah.
why do it all? You know, we've reported on it. I mean, what's the ethical reason to do it? And the reason is to tell it in a way that a very full and complete way. And that wasn't presented to us that way. It was, you know, one day you'd hear from the medical examiner, the next second you'd hear from someone at the beginning of the crime, you know, and you're like, wait, okay. And in your mind, you're sort of trying to put these things in order, but it's hard.
Right.
So it was also for us, we wanted to to better understand what we had just reported on, you kind of want to just lay it all out like a book almost and see, okay, oh yeah, that makes sense because this.
Right.
And then we learned this and, you know.
Right. It's very, it's a very complicated case and there are so many bits and pieces to it. And to what you said, Megan, you know, you guys on day one, you know, you are beholden to whatever the, you know, the prosecutor or the defense attorney or whoever is bringing to the stand that day and whatever questions they are asking. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about, like we couldn't ask questions, right? When someone was on the stand, we were observing, but we had a lot of questions when we were done. And so that was when we also said, if we're going to do this podcast, we're going to do some of our own interviews. Mm-hmm. We're going to reach out
and ask those questions we
yes,
need to ask. Yeah.
We're going to reach out to Nelly. We're going to reach out to
a criminologist. Yeah,
we're going to reach out to the families. We're going to reach out to Ted Chase. We're going to reach, I mean, and, you know, unfortunately, some of those people didn't want to talk to us for the podcast, and that's totally understandable. We get that. But I think the people that we were able to talk to did give us a lot more context. I mean, as you guys have said in the podcast, you know, being able to talk to Nelly and hearing her say something that she would never have been able to say on the stand,
right.
You know, like,
speculation.
Here's how I think that Darren Wint got in the house. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
Well, and to Katie's second question, I think it's a really good question is, you know, there's probably a difference in how we were recording when we didn't think we were doing a podcast right. to when we already knew we were doing a podcast. But it's funny, Jack and I, we would just look at that question like 2 seconds before we got in here. And didn't you say you were like, you know, we really just didn't think we were going to use a majority of it. I mean, to answer your question, Katie, I just think that like, you know, we're driving to 24th and K to check out where allegedly this van was. Jack started talking to me about, you know, okay, this is the thing I'm writing right now. And this is the thing that's not square with me. I don't really get this. And, you know, I would say something back and we would let that thing run for like 20 minutes. So what we ended up using, we used based on where it fit in the podcast, but it was all like organically what we were thinking at the time. We didn't like turn it on and we're like, okay, 3, 2, 1, Jack, this is your line. You know, that's just not the way we operate. So we wanted to give you guys a little bit of a sense of the reporting. You know, we were going out to Lanham to the Wince family house. We're going to 24th and K. Like we went to the church parking lot and what it looked like. And so you could kind of be there with us, but we didn't ever rehearse what we were going to say.
And again, that was all stuff that during the case we didn't do, right? You're sitting in a courtroom for
Yeah, 6 weeks.
So when they're talking about the parking lot or they're talking about 24th and K or whatever it is in the trial, you have no visual for that. But when you can start to put some visuals to all of these things, I think it, again, it helps paint a larger, more complete picture.
Thanks again for listening to 22 Hours. Julia is joining Jack and I as we tackle the final questions you guys sent in online.
This is from Emma, again, on the live blog. In regards to Darren's brothers, did they deny that they were involved? And another question, we'll kind of answer these together. I did have a question about the brothers that Darren stated were involved. Did he mention the brothers during the police interrogations? And if he did mention, then were they investigated?
So both of Darren's brothers denied any involvement. And we should say the prosecutors, you know, totally dismissed the defense theory of the case. They say there's no evidence linking Darren's brothers, that this was a story that Darren concocted to try to get away with murder. To the second part of the question, we don't know what Darren told police when he was arrested. We don't know if he told police anything. I mean, he could have reserved his right to remain silent. If he did tell police anything, it never was. It never came up during the trial.
And it was never entered into evidence.
Yeah, I mean, right. You said, Jack, that it's possible that prosecutors saw it and didn't and chose not to use it, or defense chose not to use it. I mean,
I would think if he told anything to the police, that prosecutors would want to use it unless the defense tried to suppress it. But generally, that kind of stuff, it may not come into the trial, but in the outside world, we're aware of it because there's hearings. You know, if somebody wants to suppress something, so then we would all know what it is. We have no indication that that ever happened. So, I think that. Probably he reserved his right to remain silent until the start of the trial.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of kind of that other part about, did he mention then were they investigated? I think, you know, Haith answered that, right?
Yeah, so we talked to Captain Haith, who runs the homicide division for D.C. police, and he said, you know, there's no evidence that the brothers took part in this. There's no evidence. You have what you have. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, you take what you have, and what we had was evidence against Darren Wendt.
Right,
we didn't have evidence against Darrell Wendt. We didn't have evidence against Stefan Wendt. And if you have evidence, then you can open up an inquiry, but you can't just start, you know.
You can't just arrest people.
Investigate people without any probable cause.
Right.
And they did test for the presence of other people's DNA in the house in addition to Darren Wendt. That would include Jordan Wallace, Sava's assistant. Mm-hmm. They didn't find anything. That would include Darrell Wendt, Darren's younger half-brother. They didn't find anything. I think they even tested for Nellie's DNA. That was one of the people. You know, so they did. One of the statements made by the defense was that police, you know, kind of zeroed in on one suspect and didn't look at other people. And I don't really know that there's a lot of evidence for that because there were other people who were investigated. Now, Stefan Wendt was never considered a suspect by anyone. I don't know if Darrell Wendt was either, but they tested for his DNA. Mm-hmm. But Stefan Wendt was Darren Wendt's younger brother who had supported him in the past, let him live with him, and had never had any connection to this case at all mm-hmm. until the beginning of the trial when the defense threw his name into the mix because he shares the same mitochondrial DNA with Darren Wendt, which means some of the evidence against Darren Wendt also could potentially link Stefan. But it was interesting, you know, because the process, and we get into this in our next episode, but prosecutors, you know, it's almost like you got the sense that they felt like the defense really wasn't kind of playing fair. And they didn't really even, I mean, they accounted for Stefan Wendt's whereabouts, but it's almost like they didn't feel like they had to. I mean, like he was a witness in this murder trial. He was not on trial himself. You know, so it was almost kind of like we don't have to, you know,
exonerate. Yeah. Somebody right. who's not charged.
Right. Like he is not a suspect. And I thought it was interesting. At this point, people will have listened to Darren Wendt's testimony and what he says happened. And he has a very detailed story. And, you know, every other word that he says practically is Darrell. But he never mentions Stefan. And in her closing argument, Laura Bach said, you know, she said neither of the brothers had anything to do with this, but she said not even the defendant had, you know, kind of the gall to come in and say anything against Stefan, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. And Darrell's a different story because, you know, he was there when Darren was arrested. He plays a little bit more of a role in the final, you know, hours before the U.S. Marshals arrested Darren Wendt. So I think that there's a little bit more of a gray area there.
And
but
prosecutors did do more work to alibi him, to show here's exactly what he was doing, you know, minute by minute.
Right.
So I feel like they felt like they had to do that for Darrell.
And when you say that, you know, Stefan Wendt, and I think we say this in the episode too, like he was just known as Darren's little brother. What we mean by that is like literally we didn't even know his name, right? We didn't even have his name until the actual trial.
Yeah.
We just knew him literally as the little brother, right?
I mean, even when they were doing, so when they we do voir dire, as it's called, so they have a bunch of jurors in there and they're making sure that the jurors who make it to the final selection are, you know, as good of a candidate as you can get to be a juror. they read off a list of names of potential witnesses, and they said to this room of like 100 people, if you hear a name that you know, and this is the prosecution and the defense, let us know, because we don't want, you know, we don't want it to come to day 29 of the trial and you say, oh, that's my brother-in-law, or, you know, whatever. And they read off a name of 15 wints, and we were scribbling down their names like our hands were on fire, because we didn't know who was who.
Right.
We didn't know who was a brother, who was a dad, who was a cousin, you know, so we were writing them down. So even until, I mean, we're talking about jury selection. It was like 2 days before the trial started, we didn't know.
Right. One final thing, you brought up the DNA that was and was not found in the house. I always found that to be one of the biggest questions I had, too. This is such a brutal crime. And the fact that police did not find more DNA.
More of Darren's DNA?
More of anybody's DNA. I mean, obviously, there was DNA that they were able to exclude, right? Like, obviously, the family's DNA is going to be all over the house, right? And people that have been in the home, their DNA is, you know, a lot of this comes down to excluding. But yeah, the, you know, how does such a brutal crime happen and the only DNA found is something below microscopic on a knife in the basement and DNA on a pizza crust?
Well, I think, and this may go back to one of the first questions, which, you know, where did the people end up, you know, the separation into the different bedrooms? And also goes to a point when we talked to a criminologist named Thomas Moriello, who works at University of Maryland, who we just kind of went to like as an outside expert. He didn't work on this case in any capacity, but we shared, you know, documents and crime scene photos with him to kind of give us an expert's opinion. And, you know, we asked him about, you know, this being such a brutal crime, it taking place over the course of a day that the assailant was in this house and leaving behind, you know, such an overall small amount. And he said, yeah, but, you know, one area that the crime took place in was completely destroyed by fire.
Right.
Why would you start a fire? Maybe that's where he was. You know, so maybe we know, as Megan said, we know where the victims ended up, but we don't know how this crime was unfolding. Maybe the majority of it took place in that bedroom that, you know, just completely burned.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes back to the fire. I mean, it just, you know, the fire changes everything. It changes when what you know about the victims and what happened to them and when it happened to them. It changes the DNA. It changes any kind of physical evidence that was left in that room. I mean, it's what's interesting about this, doing this kind of our own investigation, is you really learn, you put yourself in the shoes of these first responders and these investigators. Like the first episode where you're doing the right-hand search with the firefighter, it's, I mean, I didn't even know they did that, you know? So take that one example, but then to be an investigator on this case and to see what happened to these people and not be able to pull the physical evidence you want. I mean, you guys think you're frustrated not knowing where the van was parked. I mean, try, you know, being an investigator on this case and putting 4 years into it, you know, and not knowing some of the basic parts of this investigation. I think there's frustration all around this case. I can't even imagine for the families. And there's just a lot we don't know. And unfortunately, a lot of that comes back to the fact that Darren Wint started a fire in that house. So I guess we'll wrap it up there. Thanks again for sending us those questions. As I mentioned, we're going to do this again at the end of the podcast, take some more questions of the ones we didn't answer here and get into the details that you guys, you know, want to know the answers to. We might even let Jay-Z host that podcast as well.
Thank you. You're going to have me back. I'm so excited.
Her name is Julia Ziegler, so we call her Jay-Z around here. That's her nickname. Send us your comments and your questions on our blog, 22hourspodcast.com, or on Twitter, at 22hourspod. Also, if you've been having any technical issues with the podcast or anything you want to let us know about, shoot us an email at podcast@wtop.com. Unfortunately, we can't respond to Apple comments, so that way we'll be able to give you some answers. And be sure to hit those stars and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help us share our hard work so more listeners can find it. We'll be back next week with a regular episode. Here's a little bit of a preview. Thanks for listening.
On the next episode of 22 Hours, An American Nightmare.
Their officers followed Wint's car and another vehicle into D.C. after they spotted them leaving a Maryland hotel.
A reporter's first impressions of the chaotic scene as U.S. Marshals arrested Darren Wint.
What was this truck about?
You know, you wonder, is it stacked with cash? And this, it wasn't a small van. This wasn't a pickup truck. This was the size of what you'd rent, you know, to move a small apartment.
And for the first time, we hear Darren speak.
This ain't over yet. And if I gotta go, they're gonna go with me too. So this might be the last time you talk to me.
This podcast was written, edited, and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.